I'm Ophira Eisberg from Ask Me Another. Every week we play nerdy games with contestants and celebrities. Hear Patrick Stewart dramatically read Taylor Swift lyrics, or learn how many quills there are on a porcupine. Find Ask Me Another on the NPR One app or wherever you get podcasts.
Hey, Stephen.
Hello, Linda.
Stephen, I don't know how much you remember about the 1970s, but today we're going straight back to 1973, or at least to a movie about 1973. Specifically, we are going to talk about Emma Stone and Steve Carell playing tennis players Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs in the new movie, Battle of the Sexes.
All that, plus we will run down, as always, what is making us happy this week.
Before we get started, let's introduce our other panelists. You know Glenn Weldon, who writes for NPR.org. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Linda.
And in our fourth chair, a music writer and editor who's been published at NPR as well as by Bitch Magazine and other outlets, it's Katie Presley. Hi, Katie.
Howdy.
I'm always so happy to see all of my pals. Battle of the Sexes is about a 1973 exhibition match that King and Riggs played when she was at or near the very top of women's tennis, and he was a 55-year-old former Wimbledon champ. He was proud of his status as what he called a male chauvinist pig, and she played him in a match at the Houston Astrodome that became a hugely hyped TV event. And as we said, Emma Stone as Billie Jean King, Steve Carell being a very Bobby Riggsy Bobby Riggs, I felt. I want to ask Stephen, you like me, you remember the 1970s.
I do.
How did you like this movie?
Well, I can't necessarily speak to how effectively it treats the story of the day since I was 1 year old at the time.
Uh-huh.
So I don't remember the 1970s that well.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I thought that this was a very compelling story with several very, very compelling performances at their center. But the farther you radiated away from those central performances, the less interesting it was. I felt like the first 20 minutes of this movie in particular, I found went through these very, very stiff beats. I thought the Bill Pullman as the sexist head of the tennis organization was just twirling a big old figurative mustache. But when you get to the center, I thought this Emma Stone performance is really, really nice as Billie Jean King. And I thought that having Steve Carell, who is such an affable clown, play Bobby Riggs, who I knew entirely as a villain, I was interested in how he fleshes out that Bobby Riggs character as more of like a heel in wrestling than as an actual villain. I think it's very clear who Billie Jean King thinks is a villain, and I think the movie takes that same approach.
Right, so that it's more the tennis establishment, the men
right.
who ran tennis at the time.
And Margaret Court. She hates Margaret Court.
Yep.
Margaret Court, another top tennis player who played Bobby Riggs first and lost to him, which is one of the ways that I think Billie Jean King, according to this movie, and to some degree in real life, felt backed into a corner to play him she had refused in the past.
Mm-hmm.
What'd you think, Glenn?
This is a crowd-pleasing movie. I was in the crowd. I was pleased. I mean, you can feel the contemporary prism that's pressing down on this movie in a big old way. If it wasn't for those two central performances, so much of the dialogue in Emma Stone's mouth, in Steve Carell's mouth, wouldn't work under any other circumstances, but just because of the strength of those performances, I totally bought it. Didn't mind the contemporary prism, the fact that Alan Cumming is a magical gay man.
Yeah.
He really is. As ever.
Yeah.
I know, it's typecasting, but I mean, he is just imparting this Morgan Freeman-esque wisdom.
Yeah. For the first
really
time, color.
Exactly.
Well, right, because so Alan Cumming plays the designer who accompanies the women once they establish a separate tour, the Virginia Slims circuit, as it was, rather than just wearing white, which was all that was done in tennis at the time. They began to wear, you know, tennis dresses with color. And he plays this designer who kind of accompanies them on the tour and is, as Glenn says, kind of a magical gay person. I was interested in how it feels different and how it feels the same to have him be a magical gay person giving her advice when rather than being a straight woman like in The Devil Wears Prada and stuff like that, she is a gay woman who is kind of tentatively, I think by this point she knows that she's attracted to women, but she's married to a man and she's certainly not out. She's not, and I think she's only maybe like halfway out to herself, it
right.
seems like.
Absolutely.
I don't know. But I was interested in how different it felt.
Yeah. I mean, the tension of that relationship she enters into, or at least the hookup that she enters into, whatever you might want to call it, was the least interesting part of the film to me, only because it felt so earnest, felt so colored by our contemporary understanding. And the people who were made to seem like villains did seem like villains. Sarah Silverman is great. She doesn't get enough to do. She's not on screen long enough. But I would love to see her get a Best Supporting Actress nod.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what it is. Is it the two Sontag streaks in her hair? Is it that her character is named Gladys? I suspect a lot of the work is being done by the fact that Gladys... What a great name. Let's bring back the name
but
Gladys.
But she's constantly like walking around. She's the one who hooks him up with Virginia Slims. And she's constantly walking around sort of saying... Would you all please smoke? Because the sponsor would like to see you smoke.
Yep.
All right. Katie Pressley, speak to me of how you responded to this movie.
So I was not remotely born in the 70s, not even a little bit.
I know.
So my viewing of the 70s was mostly laughing at how 70s sex scenes play, which is endless zippers and the rustling of scarves.
Yeah.
And I agree, I was compelled by all of the same performances. I also thought the Bobby Riggs' son character was was an interesting character. He didn't do that much, but he did enough to lie down some infrastructure.
Yeah.
That was like, okay, Dad, another idea. Mm-hmm. And then he kind of does get behind him, but then also backs off at the end.
Yeah.
And is sort of like, go play your tennis, but I don't actually know what you're fighting for here.
Right. You see him kind of trying to draw boundaries and... The son kind of trying to decide like how much he wants to be involved in this very big personality
becoming historic
that his father has.
Right.
It's interesting to me because I read a review of this movie in the National Review, which said essentially the problem with this movie is that it doesn't understand that Billie Jean King is just this boring grind who does her homework and all that stuff and doesn't understand that we... quote unquote, we only would ever want to hang out with Bobby Riggs because he's awesome and funny and he's so much fun. And, you know, he's calling women names and it's just all in fun. And specifically, the review drew a parallel to the recent election and said Hillary Clinton was just a grind who did the homework, but nobody cares about that. They want to be around a fun guy. And Slate had a similar piece that said, here are all the parallels between politics and the film. And I do think one of the things that I responded to in the film was this feeling that Billie Jean King was cornered.
Absolutely. Oh, my gosh. She was almost furious to have to do it.
Billie Jean King seems to have felt like she had no choice. Mm-hmm.
She said no and said no and said no. Riggs asked her first.
Yeah.
She said, absolutely not. You're a hustler. You're a gambler. I'm not trying to get in on your next big score.
Right. And also, it's no win for her.
Exactly.
Because, and you can see what actually happened, right? Because they played and she beat him.
Handily.
And, you know, many years later, you still have John McEnroe saying to our very own Lulu Garcia-Navarro, I mean, clearly he thinks there's a good chance he could beat Serena Williams even now. Mm-hmm. And so it didn't do anything for women's tennis,
right?
For her, like, all it did was protect against him being able to continue to say, as some people were saying after he beat Margaret Court, women are inherently inferior. Right. It sort of provided some defense for some people against that. But it's not like it meant people said, well, when
feminism
tennis
won.
Exactly. The way that they tell the story in the movie, which I think is a really effective story of how it sometimes feels to be a woman publicly, is that she feels like she has to go play this guy on his terms.
Right.
And if she loses, then it really means something about her. But if she wins, it's a joke.
And the movie tries to give you lots of really satisfying shots of stressed out misogynists, right? As the game is turning, they're all starting to smoke and they're like, come on, Bobby, do it, buddy. And that's, I think, supposed to be satisfying, but I was just getting angrier and angrier. And I mean, I looked over at one point and Steven was crying and I was furious.
Yeah. Were you crying because you felt bad for Bobby Riggs?
No.
Oh, okay.
No,
I was
going
to say,
no,
I'm
no,
never
no.
talking to you again.
No, I was crying because there was music.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Swelling athletic triumph.
I am incredibly easily manipulated by music. Even when I don't like a movie, I can cry at the swelling of music. It's it's really shameful.
Yeah.
But tell me about, I don't watch a lot of sports films. This is a sports film, but it's also the dynamics, the sexual dynamics, the cultural dynamics of this film are, I think they add to the sports thing. Because in sports films, the opponents of our heroes aren't necessarily evil or short-sighted or, you know, they're not position.
So you've never seen The Mighty Ducks.
See, I certainly have not. But those scenes you mentioned, Katie, with a bunch of people in a old-fashioned gentleman's club with mm-hmm. their bourbon and their cigars going harumph, harumph, harumph. I mean, I actually heard a harumph at one point. This is what I mean about crowd-pleasing. This is the kind of film mm-hmm. that the Academy Awards are going to really like, because mm-hmm. this reinforces a certain part of the population's feelings about, it says they're right.
So let me respond thusly. Mm-hmm. You are right that that is unusual in your sports movie like Rocky, mm-hmm. The Mighty Ducks, The Karate Kid, the idea of these broader social implications. But film has always acknowledged that in historical films about sports, they typically explain or investigate how sports, like any piece of culture, is connected to what is going on in the broader culture at the time. Mm-hmm. Sports has never been disconnectable from politics. If you look just at this film and what is going on in women's tennis, obviously there are questions about feminism and, you know, the fact that they have to be fighting to be paid equally for tournaments. But you also have the fact that this particular group of women is generally a group of white women. Mm-hmm. Tennis has had, you know, obviously a very fraught relationship at times with race. There are stories of transgender people inside tennis and women's tennis where that has been an issue for them, too. The issues of sexuality are deeply embedded in this story, mm-hmm. as are in many sports, labor issues and all kinds of other stuff. So I think you're right that sports films do not always, like, if you, it is an interesting kind of hybrid of a sports movie like The Mighty Ducks, where you're mostly supposed to be looking at this person versus this person and rooting for them to win, versus historical sports films, like a film about Jackie Robinson
exactly.
or Jesse mm-hmm. Owens
right.
or something like that. Or Mighty Ducks 2, that's a joke, where you're supposed to see a broader historical context mm-hmm. because sports has never been separatable from politics.
Mm-hmm. Never.
I feel.
What did you guys think of the Steve Carell performance in general?
I like it. I think it's very him.
Yeah, it's showy, but I mean, that's what's called for.
I thought it was a really incredibly effective use of Steve Carell. Mm-hmm. Compared to his performance in Foxcatcher, which was Oscar-nominated and very highly acclaimed, in which he's acting through nose putty, mm-hmm. here he's acting through capped teeth.
Mm-hmm. Through a shiny silver workout suit that made me sweat just to look at.
Yeah. Including one that had, was it the Sugar Daddy logo on it? Mm-hmm.
That's what he played in. That's what he famously played in Imagine.
Man. I hadn't thought about Sugar Daddy candy, that is, for a really, really long time.
It's interesting. I've read a bunch of reviews of this film, and I think the initial wave, there was a lot of, this film goes way too easy on Bobby Riggs. People had, a reflexive attitude that, like, why are they soft-focusing Bobby Riggs? And I actually thought that
oh, God, I found him infuriating.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Like, to me, it reframes him from a wrestling villain into a more complicated clown,
right.
but like also just like a hustler. He's in a way, clearly, you know, Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs were friends in real life.
Dear friends.
Like, to the point where, like, there were, like, deathbed conversations kind of thing happening. They were very close. And Billie Jean King and her partner are consultants on this film. And so it's very clear that King had a way that she wanted Riggs to be portrayed. But I actually do think it's more interesting to present him as somebody who was, like, wanting to let her in on a bet mm-hmm. and coming to her and saying, they want to pay you this, let's do this crazy thing. And he is more just clueless to the bind that it puts her in. Like I said, I found it more interesting at the center, but once you have Bill Pullman, like, let's talk, you talk about a thankless, pointless role.
Yeah.
Sure.
Like, he is just given nothing interesting to do, especially when he is sitting next to TV's SpongeBob,
yes.
Tom Kenny,
yep.
who is literally saying, fact, women cannot, burp, 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 burp. Like, oh, man.
Okay, but,
understood.
But back as to Bobby Riggs, I do want to say, he may be clueless, but if you are exploiting sexism mm-hmm. as part of your little circus act, mm-hmm. are you innocent because you sort of go, I don't know, just wasn't thinking about it that way. Like, oh my gosh, I found him infuriating.
The Billie Jean King interview on Fresh Air, she got asked a very similar question, and her response can be summed up by her saying, well, he was definitely a chauvinist, a really nice chauvinist. Which is, I mean, I was able to do both. I was able to sit with a deep feminist lens watching this and say, yep, here's a guy at the end of his rope, his prime years as a champion completely robbed by World War II. This is somebody who absolutely did not receive the recognition for the heights of his career that he would have 10 or 20 years later. He's washed up. His marriage is on the rocks. He's a gambler, compulsive gambler. This is a big score for him. This is like, I'm going to use the language of the day to get back in the circuit. I mean, I'm sure he wanted to win, but I don't think he needed to win. I think he wanted to be on the tip of everyone's tongue.
It was completely possible to make this film less complicated and more engineered toward the uplift that it eventually achieves by not having any daylight between the Bill Pullman character and Bobby Riggs. You'd have a much simpler, more straightforward film.
Yeah.
It is to their credit that they decided to make that distinction. That's one of the things I liked about it.
Yeah. There just was something about the way she was trapped into this. If you don't play, you lose.
Right.
And if you do play, then you're sort of giving in to his framing of what it just
total
to me
false dichotomy.
And a lot of this is not her experience, it's my own experiences, but it's that feeling of like, if you don't come and meet me on my, you know, my rules, on the sort of ground that I'm laying out, then you lose. But once you come to me, I've made you come to me, and you sort of still lose.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, I think it's a really, really good movie. I liked it a lot. I love that Emma Stone performance. Mm-hmm. If you get a chance to see it, it is out now as we drop this episode. And come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH and tell us what you thought, or tweet at us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, what is making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from ABC. With Marvel's Inhumans, where on the dark side of the moon exists a civilization of Inhumans, with two brothers battling for one throne. Experience the first chapter of this new saga now in IMAX theaters. Get tickets now at beinhumaninimax.com and watch the complete series on ABC, Friday starting September 29th. Marvel's Inhumans. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Brooklinen. They make luxury sheets at non-luxury prices. By cutting out the middleman, they bypass costs and pass the savings on to you. With Brooklinen, they offer two different types of weaves: buttery soft luxe, soft, smooth, and perfect for year-round comfort, or crisp and cool classic, lightweight and breathable. Mix and match your way to bed perfection. Shop now at brooklinen.com and use code HAPPYHOUR to get $20 off plus free shipping.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, kick us off. What is making you happy this week?
At NPR Music, we will occasionally put together a video presentation of an interview or a video presentation of a performance. Usually it is an NPR personality talking to a musician or something similar to that. This past week, we did a conversation between the singer Devante Hines, who has performed under the name Blood Orange. He's worked with Solange. He's worked with Carly Rae Jepsen. He's in his early 30s, and the interview takes place in his apartment, and it is him interviewing Philip Glass, who is 80. And the conversation winds up being... The conversation's only about 7 minutes, but it has this lovely sprawl to it, and it's just these two guys who would seem to have very little in common, but who are both so effusive about their love of music and their interest in music and their knowledge of the life of a musician. It is just this incredibly charming... When you think Philip Glass, you don't necessarily think bubbly, but he kind of burbles happily in this way that I had never seen from him before. It's very much like a conversation with your lovable, effusive grandpa, if he had just seen Hamilton.
I thought it was so great. I thought, oh, maybe Jefferson was like that. Maybe Jefferson was a hip-hop guy.
I can't get a ticket.
They're talking in a language that you know, and they're supposed to be the Founding Fathers. Well, They're hipsters. It was really, you gotta see it.
Yeah.
It's very, very cute. It's called When You Gonna Get a Real Job? Philip Glass and Devante Hines Compare Notes at NPR Music.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon. What is making you happy this week?
American Vandal is a Netflix original series. Came out a couple weeks ago as we tape. 8 episodes, and it isn't what I thought it was, and that is to its credit. The premise is that we take a very meditative, true crime documentary series approach, using all the tools that we know from Making of a Murderer and The Jinx and Serial, for that matter. You know, very slow investigation that parcels out the revelations slowly over the course of the episodes. The documentarian becomes part of the document that he's documenting, and that other people around the documentary start to pay attention to it and become involved in it as well, borrowing a lot from Errol Morris and, you know, very arty shots. But instead of a murder at the center of American Vandal, there are 27 cars in a high school parking lot, faculty parking lot, that get spray painted with 27 penises. That makes it sound broad, right? Because it is a mockumentary, but there's no mocking in it. It is not interested in mocking the form. It is interested in just cradling and taking the form and just aping it so exactly that that becomes the source of humor. Yeah, there's a couple jokes. Because Spinal Tap, right? Spinal Tap was taking Heavy Metal Parking Lot, using that as kind of a framing device, and then doing gags, visual gags, dialogue gags. This is about capturing the feel of Making of a Murderer, then Jinx and everything like that. We also get drawn into the web of this high school. I binged this thing all 8 hours on Sunday night until 3 o'clock in the morning because I wanted to find out what happened. The jokes, the presence or lack of that. I mean, it's funny, but it's not laugh out loud funny. Mm-hmm. It is just so sharply observed. So that is American Vandal. I loved it.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Katie Pressley, what's making you happy this week?
My happy this week is born out of actually a great deal of sadness, but it ends happy. So I, as you may know, am from Texas, and Texas has had some hard times. Mm-hmm. The October issue of Texas Monthly arrived last week. And from literal cover to cover, I'm going to talk about the back cover in a minute. Literal cover to cover, I knew this was exactly what I needed to be looking at and to be reading and to be consuming as my fam down in Texas is recovering from Hurricane Harvey. So the front cover is a really powerful image of the Lone Star underwater. And I hadn't seen it yet. And so, I ripped open the plastic and gasped when I saw it. And I just opened to the table of contents, and the articles are Voices from the Storm, Landfall, It'll Happen Again, and The Coming Storm. And it shines a very bright, very local light on the best and worst of Houston that was revealed, because a whole bunch of people that didn't know anything about Houston learned a lot about Houston after the storm. And I'm so grateful for this document. On the back cover is a letter to our friends in Texas from the city of New Orleans, whom, as you may imagine, knows some things about rising waters. So I'm so grateful as a Texan. I recommend it for anyone who is or is not from the great Lone Star State. I recommend that you buy this issue. It's beautiful and it's historic. I also recommend you save that money and donate it elsewhere for the time being.
Thank you very much, Katie Pressley. Texas Monthly. Read it myself. What is making me happy this week? One of the toughest tickets to get in New York earlier this year was the production of Sunday in the Park with George that starred Jake Gyllenhaal and Annalee Ashford. Sunday in the Park with George is a Stephen Sondheim musical. It's based on the painting, the George Seurat painting, where all the people are, in the park. And it kind of goes through him developing that painting and also his relationship with his mistress, and then later his great-grandson going through his own artistic stuff. And really, it's about artists. It's about the process of creation and the fact that it can be damaging to your relationships and how important it is to people anyway and how people persevere in art and creation. Just recently, they have finally released a cast album of that production. And it turns out Jake Gyllenhaal is a very good singer of Sondheim, which, if you've ever listened to any Stephen Sondheim, it's hard to sing. Mm-hmm. He is wonderful. Annalee Ashford is wonderful. It's streaming now. They're going to be putting out a CD later, but for now, you can get it on a lot of your streaming services. I wrote up one track, the song Move On, for NPR Music, which got to debut that track earlier. So you can find that on NPR Music. Music.org, and it's really wonderful. It's wonderful to listen to. It's great music, very, very moving, and made me very, very happy to hear.
I want to know how to get through to something new, something of my own.
Before we go, one more thing I wanted to mention, which is a great opportunity to hang out with our sister podcast, Code Switch. They are having a live show in Los Angeles. It's next Friday, October 6th. It's at 8 p.m. It's at the Skirball Cultural Center, Guerin Pavilion, Hersher Hall. And there, I see you, L.A. I know you worry about parking. There is free parking. And you can get a ticket to that at nprpresents.org. And one more thing, I will be there. So come and say hi. You love Code Switch. We love Code Switch. Hang out with Code Switch. You can get your ticket at nprpresents.org. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at nprmonkeyc. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, Glenn at G.H. Weldon, and Katie at Love is Maroon. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, Jessica underscore Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you're tapping your foot to right now. Thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you next week.